back for the third hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. A little later in this hour, Patty Skane from Missouri Right to Life joins us. You may have read the headline, "Suit Seeks to Block Abortion Law Passed Over Holden's Veto." The law would require a patient to meet with a physician 24 hours before getting an abortion. There is a legal challenge to this Woman's Right to Know Act that passed in Missouri over the governor's veto. We'll find out what that's all about a little later. First, earlier this afternoon, I interviewed Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois. I began the interview by asking Congressman Shimkus for his reaction to the U.S. House's ban last week on partial birth abortion.
Well, it's something that we have all been hoping for and praying for. I know you guys have talked to me about it numerous times, and it's great to see a legislative success, and now we await a sure presidential signature and this bill becoming law.
What about this Harkin amendment that had been appended by the Senate? Are you glad that the conference committee saw free to strip this out?
Well, I'm elated. I think what the pro-abortion side wanted to do was get members on record in supporting the courts and in Roe versus Wade, which most of us, especially on the House side, the vast majority, are pro-life members. Now, I don't know where they stand on the actual court decision, but it would have made it very difficult should that have been kept in the conference. It would have been a tough debate. So I'm glad the conference committee took it out.
Do you anticipate any trouble now that this conference bill has passed through the House again, its passage through the Senate before it goes back to the president's desk for signature?
Yeah, I imagine it'll still be a tough one in which the both sides will hunker down, and it makes it more important now for the great American public to get active in this debate and call their senators. I think you're fine in the state of Missouri, the state of Illinois. Obviously, we have one that would not support it. Since we're so close, maybe this time he can.
On the subject of the war, the president has proposed $87 billion to continue to pay for the efforts in Iraq, in particular the reconstruction of Iraq and the continuing military efforts there. What do you make of the news that there are those both on the Republican and the Democratic side out there on the Hill who would like to shift the lines on that bill a little bit, rework the numbers somewhat?
You know, I think the reworking numbers is okay. I'm not wedded that what the administration says is golden and always absolutely correct. But I do think we need to get to a bipartisan agreement and move this quickly. In my discussions with the field commanders, these are now the soldiers in the area, that they really need this. And remember, $87 billion, $67 is really for our military. So we're talking about $20 billion for reconstruction and repair and, you know, trying to establish at least the Iraqis want some security and they really want just a minimum standard of living, and that's what we're trying to do.
Congressman Shimkus, how do you respond to those who say, look, I seem to remember that before the war, the White House was making an estimate of $60 billion for the whole effort from beginning to end, and this $87 billion is over that, and that's on top of what's already been spent?
They're probably correct. I mean, I don't do much worry about looking at the past. The question is, what is needed now? And right now, we spend about $4 billion a month on our military presence in Iraq. The question is, how do we, as quick as possible, move to a functional democratic government that observes the rule of law, and in essence, they can self-govern, so that we can slowly move our military personnel out of theater. We do it much more rapidly with the support of the infrastructure dollars than we do if we don't have that in there.
Syndicated columnist Cal Thomas has recently asserted that Iraq, which is oil-rich, even in its dilapidated state, ought to be carrying the majority of the freight when it comes to the cost of rebuilding that country. What do you make of that?
Well, I think what people don't understand is we're using Iraqi oil revenue right now to pay for infrastructure, and we're using the seized assets that we've found all over, squirreled away and in homes and in other locations. That money's all being used right now. So the answer is he's correct, and we're going to continue to use those dollars. But the question is, how quickly do we want to help them transition? So, again, that we're not on the ground forever. We're going to have a presence there for a long time. The question is, at what size? And, again, if we can move to a standard of living that is, by our consideration, small, and we can help create some security, then I think the transition is going to go much better.
Do you think it's a good idea? This has been recently announced that the military commanders in Iraq are planning to rotate men, about, I think, 5,000 at a time, out for R&R back to the United States to kind of relieve some of the pressure on these guys who are going to be staying there a year, 18 months, stuff like this.
Well, anyone who's been in the military always loves the ability to go home and rest and recover and go back into theater. So that's what you have field commanders for. They can assess the morale of the soldiers and what's needed at what time. I'll tell you, in my visit, I think the morale was high. They're doing the job they're trained to do. They know it's a dangerous environment, but they have a love of country. And the impact they have on the everyday Iraqi has been very, very positive, and they know that.
The president has said several times, we will do what needs to be done, we will spend what needs to be spent to finish what was started in Iraq. Make the case briefly from the perspective of a fiscal conservative for the president's pledge.
Well, I think it goes down to if you believe that the primary responsibility of the federal government is the protection of its citizens, and if you believe we're at a war against international terrorism, then this is the place we need to be. And when you're at war, you are not as concerned about as being fiscally conservative as you are as winning the war on terrorism. Now, from the budgetary aspect, you can go back to, do you want to spend $4 billion a month infinitum, or do you want to move aggressively and help improve the lifestyle of the average Iraqi so that we can transition to a thriving democracy? And that's where I think we should be at and what we should be doing.
The K report came out last week. The president said, look, this shows that there was some evidence of activity with regard to weapons of mass destruction. Others are reading the report saying, look, there's nothing specific that was reported to have been found. How do you interpret the K report?
Well, I not only did his report, but I had a chance to sit down and listen to him brief members of Congress, and the search still goes on. There's no doubt that this regime, from day one in its weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, nuclear, started their development in the cloak of secrecy. So they have done this now for 30 years, and they're very, very good at it. So the search continues, and I think that anyone who says there was none present really doesn't have an appreciation for the skill of Saddam Hussein and his regime in development and the hiding. I mean, look at the UN for 12, 13 years couldn't find anything. So I think the search will continue, and we will see where that leads us. I do believe that Iraq today, because of the influence of Arabs and the terrorism coming across the border, is the number one location in the war against international terrorism, and we're fighting it now. Our men and women are dying in support of freedoms, not only for us in the United States, but of the Iraqi people. If we're successful in transitioning Iraq to a constitutional, democratic institution that loves and supports the rule of law and that joins us in the war of international terrorism, we're all going to be better off.
You've alluded to this already in our conversation, but you spent a weekend in Iraq recently. Tell us what happened.
Well, because of what we're reading, what we're seeing, I knew members were trying to get over there to get a firsthand evaluation of what's going on the ground. So I was able to get on one of the trips spend two full days in basically three areas. One is Baghdad itself. The other one is Al-Hila, which is by ancient Babylon. And the other one, the other location is up north in Mosul. They're both different and distinct. Babylon, a major city, 5.7 million people, doing well, major infrastructure needs and desires. I visited a hospital. I visited a power plant that neither of those places would be acceptable facilities in the United States. Al-Hila is a mass grave site that has anywhere between 3 to 15,000 people buried. It's one of 165 mass grave sites throughout. This guy was as bad as a Hitler or a Stalin, and bringing freedom to that country is a liberation much like what we did in Germany. And then Mosul is an interesting location. The 101st is there, and that is a city in which there is a split between the Kurds and the Iraqi Arabs, in essence. They've had peaceful transitions. They're having great success. There are some land debates as far as who owns what land through the pushing and shoving of people throughout the decades, and that's going to they're really going to attempt to resolve that conflict. But it's working. What people need to understand, there's 18 provinces in Iraq. 17 have local governing authorities. 90% of the communities have local governing authorities. Out of the 2,000 patrols that are sent out each day, there's contact in 20. 17 of those are initiated by coalition forces. Three are initiated by bad guys. So we're making great success. We just got to stay the course. I mean, the last thing we want to do is allow a couple terrorists to cause the United States to pull out and not be supportive, and then all this would be for naught.
How much contact did you have with the Iraqi people themselves in your short time there in that country?
Mostly my contact was when I was touring the power plant, Al-Dura power plant, and then the local hospital, in which time I had a chance to not only talk to the people who were taking us through the facility, but I would stop and talk to nurses and janitors and those who would speak English, even patients as they were waiting to get into the facility.
And what is your assessment of their perception of our activity there, of the men and women who are there on our behalf in Iraq?
Well, the vast majority of people are very supportive of the United States and really despised and hated the regime of Saddam Hussein. I think they, again, they're asking for two things, a simple minimum standard of living and some security. I think once we continue to show that we're there for the long haul, we're there to provide security, you're going to allow, people are going to continue to be supportive and even more open than they are today. And that's where General Sanchez says what he needs is intelligence, because he needs the people coming forward to help us root out the bad guys. And they will only do that once they have faith and trust that we're staying. Remember, we in essence incentivized the Shiites to revolt against Saddam Hussein after the Persian Gulf War. And in essence, when we did not come through, killed anywhere from 300 to 1.5 million Shiites.
Critics of the activity in Iraq have proposed two kind of worst case scenarios. One is that Iraq would simply devolve into a Muslim theocracy, and the other is that this will turn into the Vietnam-like quagmire for the United States, and that's often the comparison that's being made nowadays in the press. How do you assess those two?
Well, I mean, I was raised in the Vietnam era. Of course, I served in the Army. I did not serve in time to serve in Vietnam, but it's obviously a two different, comparing it to Vietnam, it really doesn't show a great grasp of history. Vietnam, you had the vast majority of people and a split country revolting against the United States in a Cold War era. There is no Cold War era. There is no major support of the either the criminals, the terrorists, or the Ba'athists, except for terrorism, international terrorism. So there's no really popular support of these terrorists as there was within popular support and big government support. And what would the first question, other than
the other scenario, is that Iraq will devolve into a Muslim theocracy?
And I don't think so. I think a lot of people, I mean, that's popular for people to mention that. What's interesting is people really believe that there is an Iraqi identity that's formed between Sunni and Shiites and Kurds, and it has developed over a long period of time. When they talk about the theocracy, they're mostly worried about Iran and the Shiite religions hooking up with the Shiites in the south. If people know the Iran-Iraq war, most of the battles were fought between the Shiite Iraqis in the south and the Iranians. There's really not a lot of love lost between those two elements, and so I don't think that's a major concern.
Finally, Congressman Shimkus, a major section of our fighting force in Iraq is Guard and Reservist troops. After you've been there, seen them in action, and been able to assess it from this side of the world, how do you think our guys are doing over there?
Well, the reservists, both military reserves and the guards, are just performing wonderfully. I mean, this the one army concept in which they fold right into the active duty, and you really can't tell the difference. The challenge to the guard and reserves is that they're part-timers. And after many of them have seen Kosovo, Afghanistan, and now Iraq, I think they're getting a little tired. But the vast majority of folks in the reserves appreciate the fact that they're really an important element to the regular military forces, and they understand their role. The only fear they have and challenge is when maybe their reserve pay is less than their civilian pay. And, of course, they're away from home like anyone else. But you have to still remember, we have a volunteer force. We have a volunteer active duty force. We have a volunteer reserve and guard force. So most of these people know what they signed up for.
Congressman John Shimkus, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
My pleasure. Anytime. You take care.
That's our Washington Update with Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District of Illinois. He was kind enough to join us earlier this afternoon for that interview. He mentioned a couple things in the course of that interview that I want to draw closer attention to. One of them is his visit to Iraq. He spent not last weekend, but the weekend before last there on a congressional, I think they would call this a fact-finding tour, and he visited those three areas that he talked about. And in particular, he speaks in a press release about visiting Al-Hilla, where there is this mass grave from 3,000 to 50. They don't even know how many victims are buried there. Anywhere from 3 to 15,000 victims buried at each of the sites in this mass grave. He has said in a press release, this is one of the most somber places I have ever visited, including Nazi concentration camps. Something to put a little perspective on that. The other thing he mentioned was the passage in the House of the conference committee bill to ban late-term abortion procedures called partial birth abortion. The story was in Friday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, an Associated Press story about the lopsided vote, 281 to 142. Does it seem like 8 years to you that we have been working to try and ban this, the most heinous yet developed method of abortion? The House and the Senate continually, I think three previous times, managed to ban this, only to have it vetoed, and not being able to muster enough vetoes to overcome President Clinton's veto, it remained legal. It still remains legal today. Without a doubt, there will be a court challenge to this. This is why the cost of liberty is constant vigilance. In the same way, the cost of getting anything done legislatively, and we should point out, this is the first. Doug Johnson repeatedly points this out when we talk to him. This is the first significant legislative victory since Roe v. Wade on the pro-life side. There has been, for all of the whining and the crying of the pro-choice community about how Roe v. Wade is about to be overturned, any minute now it could be overturned. One judge could make a difference. All of that is shown to be false by the fact that it has taken 30 solid years to achieve one legislative victory that all it does is curtail the most heinous method of abortion. It does nothing to touch Roe v. Wade itself. And even this ban as good as it is not perfect. It contains what some people consider to be the poison pill, that provision, that loophole for health, which, of course, will probably find people driving their Mack trucks through before it's too long. This bill, as good as it is, will be challenged. Even if it makes it through the Senate, the Senate is going to probably make it hard. They're going to want to talk about it a lot. But when they return, I believe on the 13th, they will, in due time, pass the conference bill. It'll go to the president's desk for a signature. He's promised to sign it. He will. It will be law, but it will not be enacted. The only significant legislative victory after Roe v. Wade, it took 30 years, and even with the president's signature, even going through both houses, through conference committee, back through both houses, to the president's desk with his name in ink, it still won't be a law. It still won't change a thing, because it will immediately, now there's nothing is for sure, but one will guess because of the previous modus operandi of the pro-choice forces, it will immediately be stopped by a judge someplace, somewhere, and we'll have to go through the courts. Now, they say this bill is court-proof, but they've said that about previous bills, too. Now, I'm not trying to be overly cynical. I'm just saying the next time you hear someone say the woman's right to choose is under attack and constantly threatened, remind them kindly, courteously, remind them that after 30 years of Roe v. Wade, there has been but one significant bill passed that even touches abortion. And that bill, even after a president's signature, still is not law. A little later in the hour, we're going to get a live update from Plano, Texas. In Plano, Texas, an unexpected number of clergy and lay people from the Episcopal Church USA are gathering as we speak. They're gathering not only to pray, they're also gathering to plan and to politic. Yes, that's the reality of life in the church today. They're planning to pray and plan and politic in response to the consecration of the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. Their options are limited. We'll find out what they are a little later in the hour. It's open lines until that, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back from this break, a little bit of Ellen Goodman. Or maybe we'll fit that in after we talk with the people from Texas. If you're an Episcopalian and you're wondering what's going to happen to your church, it's a big question you've got right now, isn't it? What's going to happen to your church? Maybe after this week, maybe after this break, you might have a better idea. Get ready to call 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be talking about what's going on. If you looked at USA Today today, you'll see a headline, Battle for a Church's Soul. Yes, it's the battle for the church's soul, but first they've got to figure out who gets the name and the rights to the church. That's after this. Stay with us.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
From his attention-getting 95 Theses to the Magna Carta of Evangelical Theology, the Augsburg Confession, explore the life and theology of Martin Luther through the writings of the Reformers in our new Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross. The Theology of Martin Luther by the late Eugene Klug. You can order Lift High This Cross by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross. When you call or write, be sure to mention Issues Etc. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
The Bible.
Is it a science textbook?
Answers with Ken Ham, best-selling author and conference speaker from Australia. Well, Ken, I studied physics in college, and frankly, the Bible looks nothing like a physics textbook. So how can you call it a science text?
During one of my lectures at a college, a student jumped up and said, "But the Bible's not a science textbook." I replied, "Well, you're right, and I'm glad about that, because science textbooks change every year. So if the Bible was a science textbook, we wouldn't be able to totally trust it." I then went on to say, "But where the Bible touches on science, we can trust it 100%. See, the Bible is actually a book of history that touches on every aspect of reality. It gives us the big picture in regard to biology, geology, anthropology, in fact, in every area of reality. When we take the big picture from the Bible, this approach enables us to understand the facts of the present. We can then do real scientific research to fill in some of the details. For instance, the flood of Noah's day gives us a big picture understanding of geology. Then by studying the rock layers in the present, we can gain more knowledge about what the flood did. Yes, nothing in real science contradicts the Bible's history.
Does the Bible teach that the earth and all life were created over millions of years or over six literal days? That's the theme of Ken Ham's free booklet available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
It's 5:31. We'll continue with Issues, Etc. in a minute and a half here on AM 850 KFUO and weather. Clear overnight, 60 for the low. Mostly sunny tomorrow, another warm day, 80 tomorrow's high. Right now in St. Louis, 79 with clear sky. In traffic, northbound 270 on the ramp to westbound 70. There's an accident reported. Westbound 40 between Hampton and Hanley, stop and go traffic. Westbound 70 between Cypress and St. Charles Rock Road, stop and go traffic. Westbound 70 also between 270 and the Blanchette Bridge. Slow traffic, crowded over the bridge heading into St. Charles. Westbound 40 between Chesterfield Airport and Route K, heavy traffic. On eastbound 40 between Jefferson and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic. And on northbound 55 between Park Avenue and the Poplar Street Bridge, slow traffic in the right lane.
Hi, this is Paul Clayton. I bring you news and information, inspirational Christian favorites, and conversations with great guests Monday through Friday on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO. Plus, short features like, By the Way, our thought for the day from the Reverend Paul Devanteer, Front Porch Parenting with Dr. Mary Mance Simon, commentary from Dr. Dale Meyer, it's the Meyer Minute, plus Your Creation Moment. Features on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. This is a meeting that has been planned, well, since the Episcopal Church USA this summer decided to not only elect but also confirm the first openly gay bishop, Bishop Gene Robinson of New Hampshire. It seems almost immediately there was an announcement of a meeting that would take place in Texas, and as the details got out, it appears the meeting has grown. We'll find out why Episcopal Church USA members clergy are gathering in Plano, Texas for a meeting called A Place to Stand during this hour of Issues, Etc. Bruce Mason is our guest. He's media officer for the American Anglican Council. Bruce, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you very much for having me back.
What's the scope of this meeting in terms of just the people who are attending?
Well, this is a meeting. First off, this is a meeting actually that was planned before General Convention just to be a small gathering of, well, now it seems small, but 100-150 leaders of the mainstream Anglicans in the Episcopal Church to assess what happened at General Convention. And when the convention acted as it did, it just took on a life of its own. And people just saw Plano, what was going to be the Plano meeting, and now it's in Dallas, as a place to come together to be unified with one another and to send a unified message to the worldwide Anglican leaders of the church who are meeting next week that there's a dire need for emergency intervention here in the Episcopal Church.
So what's the main question that you're dealing with there in Dallas?
Well, the main question is I think different for a lot of people, but the primary question really is, where do we go from here? We know where we've been. We know where we're not going to go back to again. The Episcopal Church has left us. It has departed from the historic Christian faith and has really thumbed its nose at the rest of the worldwide Anglican Communion. So now what we're doing is we're looking ahead. We're saying, okay, let's look forward. Let's look ahead and figure out, well, where is it that we need to be? And we're asking the primates to provide for us a new home, essentially, a new safe place for us to reside away from the harassment and the troubles that we've had within the Episcopal Church. Now, we're not leaving. We're staying faithful members of the Anglican Communion. It's the Episcopal Church that has moved away from us.
One of the leaders in the American Anglican Council has recently been quoted in the press as saying, "We must create a firewall between us and something we think is not only wrong teaching, but harmful teaching." What is the scope of the problem in the Episcopal Church USA when it comes to the confirmation of Gene Robinson to be the first openly gay bishop? How far does it reach?
Well, it's a core a biblical issue. It's not just an issue of sexuality. That's just the presenting issue. But it's a question of does the Bible mean what it says? Is God who he says he is? Does he change over time? You know, we don't obviously believe he does, and we believe the scriptures are very clear on not only this issue of sexuality, but on how we human beings are supposed to live our lives in holiness. And so this is a fundamental defining issue for this church. And the Episcopal Church, as I said, has moved away from the bedrock that is the gospel teaching on marriage and family and holy living. And so we see it as we couldn't go there. You know, it's not something that God would have approved in any way. There's no place in the Bible that says it's okay to do what the Episcopal Church just did.
You said the main question, generally put, is where do we go from here? Where can you go? What are the actual options? I mean, save someone saying, look, I'm just leaving the Episcopal Church USA, period, flying free. Where can you go as a group of conservative, scripturally oriented Anglicans and Episcopalians?
Well, we're hoping, frankly, that we don't have to go anywhere, in the sense that the Anglican primates, the worldwide Anglican leaders, will provide us a new home, whether it be a new province, for example, which would be what we would hope for, or some other kind of an entity, but something that we could then move into with our churches and our the properties and everything, if we can, so that we can, again, have this a home that's just fully connected with the Anglican Communion. There's enough primates out there, or Anglican leaders out there, who are outraged at what the Episcopal Church did, that there is a definite, and we feel comfortable that there was some action will be taken.
Presiding Bishop of the Episcopal Church USA, the Reverend Frank Griswold, apparently has sent an observer on his behalf to the meeting there in Dallas with a message that is intended to say to the American Anglican Council and those who are standing with it that they are an honored part of the church, and he is praying that God will guide the Episcopal Church USA. How are Griswold's, at least the what look like attempts to kind of bring the American Anglican Council under the umbrella of the Episcopal Church USA, how are they being received?
Well, to be honest with you, he actually didn't end up sending any observers. He sent us a letter on Friday afternoon informing us of the fact that he would be sending these observers. It's the first we'd ever heard about it. Now, the problem was that we don't have any category here at the event for Episcopal observers. If you're an Episcopalian and you desire to come to the event, we've asked folks to affirm the AAC's statement of faith, which is just an affirmation of the core biblical beliefs. And so we sent a letter back to the presiding bishop saying that if your observers would like, observers would like to come and affirm our place to stand, then they're welcome to come as participants, but that if they're coming as observers, there is no such category. Therefore, there's really no sense in their coming to the event. So they have not come, at least certainly not as participants. I don't know if they're hanging around the hotel somewhere, but they are not here, and therefore there is no letter that is being delivered.
Very recently, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, had the opportunity to have an audience with Pope John Paul II. In a joint set of speeches that they both delivered, the Pope in a rather oblique way, made reference to some difficulties, serious difficulties, he called them, that weigh very heavily upon the church. And it was widely reported in the press that he must be referring, of course, to this issue of the openly gay bishop. And he has most recently affirmed in encyclicals the opposition of the Roman Catholic Church, not only to this, but also to homosexuality in general. How is that being received?
Well, it's clear that when the Episcopal Church took the action it did, it was devastating for ecumenical relations. You had the Archbishop of Canterbury had sent emissaries to meet with some senior Muslim, I think it's professors and clerics in New York City, and they would not meet with the Archbishop of Canterbury's representatives, and certainly the meeting with the Pope. I had heard a report somewhere that, in fact, that it was articulated that this issue, if the Anglican Communion were to embrace this issue of human sexuality, that we would that it would be even more difficult to build a relationship between the two churches.
Who actually will make a decision that will actually have some binding, quote-unquote, legal authority on the disposition of the Episcopal Church USA vis-a-vis Anglicanism and your group vis-a-vis the Episcopal Church USA?
I'm not quite sure I understand that question.
Well, Rowan Williams is the titular head of the Anglicanism.
Correct.
He can talk, but nothing will happen.
Right.
You are not recognizing the authority of the Episcopal Church USA,
right,
to make decisions. Who will it be?
Well, we're in a very unprecedented situation now where you have really essentially the rise of the global south, where you have a shift of voice in many senses in moral authority to that of the global south. That means in Africa, Asia, those folks who would be in the two-thirds world. So therefore, it's really unknown at this point exactly what's going to happen and who will be. I mean, we know that the primates will likely take some sort of action. And we've never been here before. This is totally unprecedented. So how it actually, ends up playing out and how things work out, I'm not sure anybody knows at this point. But, what we're looking for is some commitment on the part of the primates to take action.
Bruce Mason is our guest media officer for the American Anglican Council. He's giving us a live report from Dallas, the site of a Place to Stand conference, a meeting of the American Anglican Council and other concerned Anglicans about the confirmation of an openly gay bishop this summer by the Episcopal Church USA. So the primates can actually speak to this issue, and they do have the authority to grant this group of Episcopalians and others, of course, nationwide, who are concerned about this, as you say, a separate province. What exactly does that mean?
Well, it would mean they would say that, the most ideal scenario from our perspective is they would say, okay, we no longer recognize the Episcopal Church USA, but we do now recognize those that oppose the Gene Robinson, the support of Gene Robinson and his confirmation. But we now recognize those folks as being either the Episcopal Church, the new Episcopal Church, or the real Episcopal Church, or the new, say, Anglican province in North America, something along those lines. So they could take those steps. It's not happened before, but they could say something like that. Now, that would be the ideal. They could also come down and simply sanction the Episcopal Church, kind of remove voice and vote, that kind of thing. And again, there's no real precedent for that, so we'll have to wait and see what they deliberate and decide about, when they meet next week. But there's clearly a need for action and a need for them to take action, and they do have the ability to take action despite the fact that there are some in the Episcopal Church among the leadership who are trying now to say that there is no authority held among the primates whatsoever, which, frankly, may well be wishful thinking on their part.
If there is, let's say for the sake of argument, that those who are arguing that the primates, not every bishop, of course, but we're talking about the primates of the Anglican Communion, have no real authority, aren't they really then saying each bishop basically is his own authority in his bishopric? There is no overall authority that can say what is an Anglican, what isn't an Anglican, who is in line with Anglican teaching. Even Lambeth is not binding, apparently.
Right. Well, I think at the bottom line of all this, the authority needs to be the gospel. And the gospel is very clear about certainly this issue and many, many others. And so at the very core level, we need to at least be obeying what the Bible says. Set that aside, which you really can't set that aside, but what we're seeing now, certainly within the Episcopal Church, is this whole anything-goes attitude, where if it's okay for you, it's okay with me. And you saw that with the vote that the Episcopal Church took, the General Convention took, on same-sex blessings, where it basically said, well, we're not going to formally approve it, but it's okay to do it in diocese. We're okay with that. And, you know, that's the same thing as approval in our mind, but it also just shows this new attitude of that there is no accountability anymore. At least that's what the Episcopal Church seems to feel. But I would argue that within the worldwide Anglican Communion, there is a growing sense that there must be accountability.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jeff is calling from his car. Jeff, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good evening. I was wondering why... Or the folks down in Dallas, they're having the vote, you know, or meeting together because of this deal with Gene Robinson. How come they waited for him to become a bishop? Why didn't they do it right away when they found out he was a pastor? So I know, like, if we ever had anything like that in the Missouri Synod where an admittedly gay person became a pastor, I would ask my pastor for an emergency assembly meeting or voters meeting, and push the vote to leave the charter with the Missouri Senate. That's just one thing that we at our church wouldn't put up with.
Jeff, thank you very much. It's a good question. Why did the American Anglican Council and others wait until the actual confirmation of Gene Robinson?
Well, it was the confirmation of Gene Robinson that really galvanized people and moved people. It sort of woke people up. I think a lot of folks, not the AAC, but a lot of folks really had lived in this almost sense of denial that unless it had touched their, you know, it reached their doorstep, it really wasn't an issue. And when the Episcopal Church acted on Gene Robinson, it really just hit home in a way that it hadn't before. We certainly have been upset with the direction of the Episcopal Church for quite some time. But quite frankly, there was, you know, we felt called to work within the system in order to try to work for change within it. But it has become impossible now. To begin to make any change. And what the convention did is that convention took a formal step. So convention moved itself out of the faith and order of the church. It acted heretically. Therefore, it took a step that it had not taken formally before. So what that did is just it was the line that could not be crossed. Even though the steps that were taken before were not right and we adamantly opposed it, all that stuff was sort of being done kind of under the, it wasn't being done formally, let me put it that way. It was sort of happening, but no one was really talking about it, at least in any formal way. But this was a formal act of the Episcopal Church.
Bruce, are you able to stay with us for another few minutes to the near the end of the hour here?
Yeah, I can stay a few more minutes. That's fine.
Okay. Do you have allies in worldwide Anglicanism? Is there any way of gauging what the viewpoint, not only from the bishops, but also from the faithful, in worldwide Anglicanism, where they stand on the issue of not only an openly gay bishop, but also same-sex unions?
Well, the vast majority of the worldwide Anglican Communion would stand squarely behind us on this issue. There's no question that the majority of the Communion is not only orthodox in its beliefs, but it is vibrantly growing because of those beliefs. It's in those places where the gospel is upheld as the centerpiece of our Christian life, and Jesus Christ is what they're about. That's the place where things are growing, and you see the churches in the West, in the Episcopal Church, and even the Church of England and other places. That is where we've moved off into these revisionist directions, into these directions that are, frankly, unbiblical. And you see a contraction of those churches. They are shrinking, and the Episcopal Church has shrunk quite dramatically since the 1950s. It's because when the church becomes like the culture, it no longer has anything to offer. And that's what the leaders of the church now are saying these days. It's that the church needs to reflect and embrace the culture so as to be more relevant. Well, the problem is it's making itself irrelevant.
Now, this is a concern that's very close to home with me. I am a member of probably what others would consider to be a very conservative Lutheran church body, small but on the same size with the Episcopal Church USA. Mm-hmm. And there are calls within our assembly, not for things like openly gay bishops, but for an accommodation to culture. Is there really a point where you can say, look, if the culture is calling the shots for the church, we can draw a line and say, we'll just stop here? Or does that necessarily, if you're consistent, letting the church, the culture call the shots for the church, does it necessarily lead in the extreme directions we have found in the Episcopal Church USA? What do you think?
Well, I think so. I think that it's sort of insidious the way it happens. You know, the culture begins to creep into the church in little ways, and then, you know, decisions are made, and once you get off that path, you know, each step you take leads you further off that path. And, you know, as I said, it's when the church ceased to stand on the gospel, when it stepped off that foundation, it began to become more and more indistinguishable from the culture. And why would somebody, if you're an individual and you're trying to figure out your way through life, and you see what the culture offers, and you turn to the church and it's offering you something totally, you know, that's not different in any way, there's really no incentive to go to the church anymore. And that is tragic, absolutely tragic, because the church needs to hold that place in our life, in our culture, in our world, that offers that hope, that transforming hope of Jesus Christ, that the way that people can live in a healthy and wonderful way. It's the church is the only institution left that really has that to offer us.
Finally, Frank Griswold is not alone, of course, when he argues both that Scripture does not condemn homosexuality, he has argued this recently, and more curiously, that God's truth is, in his terms, still unfolding. What does he mean by this second point, and how do you respond to it?
Well, that's sort of a very postmodern way of thinking, and it's basically he's saying he's basically saying that God can change his mind, or that when the Bible was written, that wasn't it. That basically that God has said, oh wait, but there's more. And you know, I heard many times it justified that, well, the Holy Spirit has led us in the direction. The folks in the Episcopal Church, you know, who support the Gene Robinson Confirmation, well, the Holy Spirit led us in that direction. Well, if the Holy Spirit, God doesn't contradict himself. And he's very clear, his word's very clear on the issue of sexuality. Therefore, it can't be the Spirit leading in a direction if it directly is contradictory to what the Scriptures say about it. So it's this whole, Griswold likes to use the phrase multiple realities. It's just that whole postmodern thinking that there's no black, there's no white, there's no good, evil. You know what I mean? Confusion, and I think that that's not only a product of the culture we live in, but it's also part of the things that help get us into the problems that we're in.
Is there any turning back for the American Anglican Council and those who have come to stand with it there in Dallas, Texas?
Well, if you mean are we willing to embrace the Episcopal Church at this point again, frankly, unless they were to repudiate all their actions and repent, we don't really have any choice but to look forward and look to our Anglican brothers and sisters for them to assist us. It's just we're not, you know, we want to be rooted in the gospel. You know, we want to uphold the historic teachings of the church. That's what God tells us to do, and we want to be faithful to our Lord.
Would it be enough for them simply to say, oops, that summer in 2003, we stepped too far over the line? Bishop Robinson, we rescind your confirmation. We'll go back to where we were before the summer of 2003. Are there problems that need to be dealt with that are not just directly related to same-sex unions and an openly gay bishop, per se?
Well, if it was genuine, if they were to say, hey, we really recognize, I mean, if it's just an oops, you know, to try to, you know, sue things a little bit, that's one thing. If it's a genuine repentance, that's an entirely different matter. But realistically, that's not going to happen.
Is the Episcopal Church USA, as it is comprised now, under Griswold, will they eventually formalize what they have made somewhat informally approval of, and that is same-sex blessings?
Well, I think there's no question that they're headed in that direction. I thought it was personally almost disingenuous of them not to go ahead and do that, because at this convention, because when they took the action with Gene Robinson, they essentially condoned that homosexual behavior anyway. So not that I would have wanted them to see them do it, but the point is that they already jumped off the cliff. It's not like one more step is going to take them even further down. They've already done it. They've already stepped over the line. They've already departed from the teachings of the church and the historic Christian faith. So we still don't want to see them do that, but it wouldn't surprise us at all if that wasn't the very next step.
Just curious, are there any bishops who are meeting with you and plan to also follow and stand with you there in Dallas?
Yes, absolutely. There's over 40 bishops with us here. Not all of those are Episcopal bishops, but we've got, I think it was 23 Episcopal bishops with us, and they are standing firm. And you have very strong resolutions coming out of a number of special diocesan conventions that were held over the past couple weeks, where dioceses are strongly repudiating the actions of conventions and of General Convention and disassociating themselves from it, and making it very clear that those teachings and those decisions will not be honored in their diocese. And they have also called, many of them, for the direct intervention of the Anglican primates.
So finally, how would you summarize this? What do you hope to accomplish by this conference, A Place to Stand, down in Dallas?
Well, we hope, again, first of all, that Orthodox believers in the Episcopal Church will begin to become unified and speak with one voice, and that because of this, a strong message will be sent not only to the Episcopal Church that we're not going to stand for the actions that they took, and also to the Anglican primates that we need your help.
Bruce Mason, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Bruce Mason is media officer for the American Anglican Council. If you'd like to contact the American Anglican Council, they have a website, AmericanAnglican.org. That's AmericanAnglican.org, or you can contact them via telephone, area code 202-296-5360. That's 202, area code 296-5360. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the 95 Theses and the Heidelberg Disputation, we'll have Dr. Timothy Dost of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis as our guest. What were these two important documents, the 95 Theses and the Heidelberg Disputation? How important are they to understanding what the Lutheran Reformation and all of the Reformation was really about? We'll talk about it tomorrow on the program. That begins and actually extends a series of conversations on our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October called Lift High This Cross. That's tomorrow. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.